You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and today we're looking at stories of faith.
My name's Elizabeth Redman. I'm a Christian. My day job is that I'm a business journalist.
Elizabeth is a woman of faith, but her work as a journalist often presents her with situations that some could see as challenging faith. She talked to us about religion and comedy.
So a couple of years ago, I was working as a comedy festival reviewer and arts writer for a straight press magazine called Beat, and I saw about 10 comedy shows during the festival and wrote reviews of them. And I'd done that for a couple of festivals previously, and a lot of my Christian friends had said to me, oh, you know, isn't that an ethical minefield, being a Christian and being a comedy festival reviewer? And so I wrote a blog post explaining that actually there weren't as many issues as people assumed that there were, and saying that for me as a Christian, I didn't have to deal with a lot of dramas that people assumed that I would have to. And I pointed to the letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, saying that when we don't have a clear teaching about how to behave, that it's okay for us to act in accordance with our conscience, but that we shouldn't act in a way that will be a stumbling block to our brothers and sisters in Christ.
Why do you think religion is targeted by comedy or comedians?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question that you're like, so why do comedians make a big deal about religion, right? Because I guess I felt compelled to write a blog post because I felt like there was this misperception that comedians made a really big deal about religion when that just wasn't my experience. I went to see 10 shows at the comedy festival. That was about 10 hours of comedy, and there were literally 2 jokes about religion in 10 hours of comedy. Like, that was it.
Have you ever heard a joke with faith or religion at its heart that's made you laugh?
Oh, there's a cute comic at a camp site that I've been to on church camps a couple of times that has a picture of some people having a swimming race, and there's like Peter walking on the water and Moses walking through the water that's being parted and someone else walking through the water saying, oh, I think I'm at a bit of a disadvantage. So that made me laugh. It's a bit cutesy.
This next piece is from Zoe Ferguson, who went out and asked a simple question with some complex answers. What do you believe?
I believe.
I don't believe in God.
I believe.
I believe in science.
I believe.
Scientology is my religion.
I believe. Hi, my name is Jessie Peters. I'm 26 years old. I was brought up in Sydney and I was raised a Catholic, but I'm currently an atheist.
Hi, my name is Faraz, or Faz. I'm 25 and I'm from Fiji, but I've lived in Sydney for 7 years. Obviously, Faraz Ali would infer that I am Muslim.
Hi, my name's Virginia. I'm 44 years old and I currently live in Parramatta. I actually grew up in a Scientology family that had a very strong Catholic element as well.
So basically, I was raised quite a strict Roman Catholic, which means when I was young, we used to have to go to the Latin traditional mass. So as a young child, I couldn't even understand what was being said in the mass. That's some of my earliest memories, having to wake up early in the morning and go to church and sit there for a few hours and being bored. And my mum always used to tell me that I just used to constantly pull on her arm and say, when are we leaving? So as a young child, I knew I didn't like that kind of experience, but it was something I think my mum, who was a single mum, thought it was important to teach me those kinds of values from a religious perspective. And I think she thought if she didn't provide me with that kind of moral ground, she wasn't doing her job as a parent. I was actually very young when I started questioning religion, between 8 and 10. I found a lot of inconsistencies in what my mum was teaching me, and I always used to ask her questions about it, and she would always say to me, that's not for me to answer, you just need to have blind faith. And even as a child, I never accepted that blind faith was enough. I needed to have proof, and I never found that the church provided enough proof for me as an individual. And I know there are people out there that are happy to accept what the teachings say to them, but for me, I would always question. But there was never any answers that covered that, because the texts that these people are reading are very old and they're not suitable for our current society. So that was my main problem. There was just a lot of inconsistencies, and I never was able to be satisfied with what my mum would tell me was the truth. I do definitely get very frustrated. I'm a very big supporter of Richard Dawkins' child indoctrination theory. I definitely do believe that I was indoctrinated as a child. And it took me, even though I quite used to question religion, it took me a long time to kind of shed the guilt that I felt from being raised a Catholic and then realizing I can actually do things that they're telling me that are wrong and not have a negative impact on me from the supernatural entities that they try to scare you from. Children are just too young to understand all the elements in a religious text. And I think it should be an adult choice to be a religious person. When you're kind of like indoctrinated, if you read something like about evolution, for example, your instinct is to straight away reject it. And you don't want to open yourself up to that because you feel like it's against your religion. But your rational brain knows that evolution is, there's so much support of it that you can't discount it as a valid theory. So there's this kind of a conflict between your rational brain and the indoctrinated state. And to me, when I read that book, it just helped me kind of clarify all that conflict that I had and all the guilt I felt to kind of rejecting my religion. And I just thought, I don't need to feel guilty anymore. I can just move ahead with it and keep reading about science and not feel bad that I agree with evolution.
I did actually participate in Ramadan once or twice. By the time I was about 13, though, I became disillusioned with the way that Islam worked. It's not to say that there's anything wrong with Islam, because there isn't. It's a beautiful faith. My issue was that in Fiji specifically, which is different from here, I understand, but you know, when I used to go with my father to the mosque, which I did only once a year during Eid at the end of Ramadan, my mother wasn't allowed to come with us. So, and I'm incredibly close to my mother. So I was like, this is really strange. I was like, why can't mom come and pray with us? But nobody could explain it to me. So I became a little bit delinquent within the confines of the institution. And then, you know, I was 12 and 13, becoming more serious in terms of exploring my faith. And then I just couldn't do it anymore. I felt that there was some sort of disconnect. And somehow for me, I was like, all right, well, there is no God. I became sort of like a hard out militant atheist for many, many years. I came to my last year of high school, and a friend of mine, her name was Esther Sue. I went to my locker and I got my books, and I was walking past the library, and she comes up next to me and she was like, look, she was like, I know you wanted to know what my parents do, but I just wanted to tell you that I don't have parents. Like, it's just not something that I have. So we're like walking to class. And within that time, she told me this like horrible, horrible story about her life. But I was sort of like, well, how did you get through all this? Like, how is it that like you go from being like an abandoned fatherless child, basically, to this? How are you so stable? How are you so put together? And she was like, it's church, it's God. And then I was like, oh, another one. And I was like, no, Esther, no, it's because you're strong. It has nothing to do with God. And she was like, no, she's like, my strength comes from God. So we had sort of this debate. And she's like, why don't you just come to church with me? So I went to church with her. And, you know, it was at that point at the church in Fiji where it was called the Calvary Temple that I felt something listening to the pastor speak, because a particular service that I was listening to was about love. And I think that particular message has resonated with me throughout my journey now with God and believing that he's real. I needed to understand where my friend was coming from first before I could find out sort of where God was coming from. So I started to read. I tried to understand it and understand what this faith was, because, you know, churches are very conservative. I am gay. So again, it was, you know, a conflict, because I was like, oh, no, you can't, like, it doesn't make sense. Like, you'd have a God who, like, kind of hates you. No. I've always had this feeling that that gay people shouldn't have to come out. You fall in love, and then that's what happens. So it shouldn't matter because it's completely natural and completely real, and it's the way that God makes people. The journey from that, I suppose, was reconciling my faith with my sexuality, which came later and very harshly.
The word Scientology means knowing how to know, comes from the Latin. Through Scientology, we believe in God. We do not doctrinate as to what God is. And through Scientology counselling and also study of the religious philosophy, each person comes to a full awareness of who they are and their relationship to God and the universe. Through Dianetics, that was the first book by Mr. Hubbard, that researches the mind, and the word itself is what the soul is doing to the body through the mind. And that addresses the two parts of the mind, the analytical mind that we use when we're awake, and then the hidden part, which most people know as the subconscious mind. We call that the reactive mind. During times of pain and unconsciousness, memories are stored in that part of the mind, and they can later react upon a person, dictating them into behavioural patterns and psychosomatic illnesses below their awareness level. So in Scientology, we address that through spiritual counselling. Through that process and research, Mr. Hubbard found that people were coming up with memories of previous lives. And when they talked about them and discussed them, they actually got better and had relief. And so as a young child, I was brought up in a Scientology type environment, but I went to a Catholic school. Always had sort of exposure to lots of religions, and I've had a strong interest in understanding lots of religions, but Scientology is my religion. And as a teenager, I sort of chose it for myself. So I grew up around it, and I did different courses as a child, but I chose it probably more when I was 18 to take very specific courses and also to start working for the church. As a Scientologist, we believe that we've lived before. So for me as a child, I always had that as a very strong, I just had it as that is how it is. So when I came across other people who were like, well, you die and that's it, your body's gone and there's nothing left, I was like, well, no, you don't. You live again. When I was younger, it was like, oh, no, you know, it's a very Christian ideal. Now there's a lot more of Eastern philosophy that has seeped into our culture, and a lot more, you know, Buddhist and Hindu type philosophy has come into our everyday existence, so people are very accepting of it now. But for me as a kid, that was a total given. There's no way that you just lived one life, and that was the very first thing that I sort of remember. That's what disappoints me about some religious groups, is the pointing of the finger of like, your faith is wrong, your belief in God is wrong, this is the only way. And I think religions conflicting like that has caused a lot of trouble throughout history, and every religion has something to give people. There's a lot of similarities that when you study different religions, you get to see a common thread that goes, travels through them all, and that we all share goals of, you know, betterment of mankind and that sort of hope, which also non-religious people have as well. But there's a lot more similarities than people would otherwise think.
I believe in Zoe Ferguson, the producer of that piece. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and today we're bringing you stories about faith. Elizabeth Redman is a Christian and a journalist. She came into the studio to talk to us about her faith. I didn't think climate change reports and the Bible would have much in common, but apparently, faith is needed for more than just religion.
So, it would have been about a year ago. It was a really hot summer. I think the Climate Commission called it the angry summer because so many weather records were broken. It was just so hot. And I just finished, well, studying and teaching a Bible study series on the Gospel of Mark. And I was researching climate science for a feature article that I was writing at work. I believed that climate change was real, you know, and I knew that the world's top scientists agreed that climate change was real, but I didn't really know very much about how that worked. And so I was reading at work for this feature, kind of a report by the Climate Commission that sought to bring together all the research explaining how scientists know that the globe is warming. And so something that I found out that I didn't know before is that the way that we know that there is global warming is not because we measure temperatures and go, oh, look, the globe's getting warmer, therefore global warming. Actually, the way that scientists know there's global warming is because of the greenhouse effect. And so that means that carbon dioxide emissions get trapped in the atmosphere and they make it warmer. Scientists can kind of look at physics, look at the greenhouse effect, and then measure temperatures and find that that confirms what they already know. And so I found that out and went, huh. And something else that I was reading about is how the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change produces its reports every 6 years. When it did its fourth report in 2007, which was the most recent one at the time I was writing, that was written by 1,250 expert authors and then double peer reviewed by 2,500 expert reviewers who produced 90,000 comments on drafts. And I found that out and just went, whoa, climate change is real.
All the research that you've done on climate change, how does that correlate to the gospel according to Mark?
So I found that the process was really similar in finding that the evidence for climate change was overwhelming. I also had the experience of studying Mark's gospel and finding that the evidence that Jesus is God in Mark's gospel is overwhelming. And I'd already been a Christian for a long time. Like, yeah, this wasn't kind of radically new information to me. So Mark was writing a biography of Jesus, and something that he was doing was showing people that Jesus is God. In the first chapter of Mark's gospel, a lot of people were going to a river called the Jordan River to be baptized, and Jesus went there too. But when he went to be baptized, Mark says that he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my Son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." And then the next thing that happens is that Jesus actually calms a storm. So he and his disciples are in a boat on a lake, and there are waves breaking over the boat, and Jesus is sleeping, and someone wakes him up and says, "Don't you care if we drown? Like, can you come and help, please?" And Jesus says, "Quiet, be still." And then Mark tells us that it was completely calm. And so obviously, like, I've never met a human who has the power with their words to calm a storm. And then he walks on water. And then he says to his disciples, "Who am I?" And Peter says, "You are the Christ." And I remember getting to that point and going, yeah, Jesus is God. The evidence is overwhelming. It's just like believing in climate change, believing that Jesus is God.
When you were researching this, did you read any literature by climate change skeptics?
So I would, if there was. So there was a researcher for The Conversation who used an academic journal search function to search for peer-reviewed papers by the most prominent climate skeptics about climate change, about climate science, and there weren't any, so I didn't read them.
Do you ever read literature from staunch atheists, like Richard Dawkins?
I've never read anything by Richard Dawkins. Yeah, I guess because I'm busy reading the Bible. But I mean, like, I would be open to reading something by Richard Dawkins.
I don't know if anybody's ever peer-reviewed the Bible, but that's a bigger project than we have time for today. Today on All the Best, we're hearing stories about faith. A new church has opened in Sydney, but there's a funny thing about it. There's no God. It's called Sunday Assembly, and basically, it's a church for atheists. Jacqueline Breen went along to a service.
Okay, so I'm sitting by these big, bright windows in Redfern Town Hall with Cecilia. A little red-headed baby boy is playing on the floorboards next to us. And now, I'm not religious, but the way the sun is shining through that window, the way it's bouncing off his hair, and this little curl next to his little ear is backlit and glowing, it's kind of miraculous. Cecilia is a very nice young lady, but she's sitting here telling me about the plan that she had to scam her way into her local church.
I was joking to my husband about a month before we heard about Sunday Assembly in Sydney. I joked, "Do you think it would be morally wrong if we pretended to believe in God and went to our local church so that we could get the, you know, the mingling and the playgroups and all that?" But you know, secretly not believe in God, and he sort of said, yeah, I don't think we'd be able to pull it off.
So Cecilia doesn't believe in God, and she's not one for organized religion, but she can see some things in that world that she likes.
As my boys get older and I've sort of read a bit of stuff online and in books about the importance of, especially boys growing up, having male role models. And I was trying to think back to my own childhood. I grew up in a Catholic family, and for me, I had a lot of adult role models through the church that I went to. And I sort of felt like our kids were going to miss out if they didn't have that other aspect of their life where they had adults that sort of had similar ways of thinking to us that they could look up to. So I'm hoping that could be something eventually that we can get from this as well. It's like,
and that is what this Sunday Assembly stuff is all about. That's what they're getting at. This is all the best bits of church without the religion. So for something that's not church, it feels a lot like church. First of all, it's on a Sunday morning. All the other heathens are hungover or having brunch or going to the beach. It's in this grand old building, Redfern Town Hall, big marble staircase, lots of light and air. There are these nice kind of older, friendly people at the door to say hello. Rows of chairs facing the front, fold-up tables with tea and cake up the back, and there's a church band on stage. Sorry, a not church band. This little clump of teenagers. They're holding their instruments like they've heard of sex and drugs and rock and roll, but never actually tried it themselves. And they play these songs you could probably call secular hymns. Everybody knows the words. They're easy to sing along to, and they're kind of naff. That guy you can hear sort of singing, this is all his idea. Sydney's first Sunday Assembly is taking place just about a year after it started on the other side of the world. It was a couple of stand-up comedians, actually, in London who first got it together. One of them, Sanderson, tall, scruffy, blonde guy, is here today.
I'm sure there's lots of people here who know what this is, but there's probably some people who decided to come even though they don't really know what it is. So I should explain. The Sunday Assembly, we are a godless congregation that celebrates life. We've got an awesome motto, which is live better, help often, and wonder more. And our mission, it's very simple, is to try to help everyone live this one life as fully as possible.
Everyone is welcome here, Sanderson says. The atheist label is actually kind of clumsy because here it doesn't matter if you believe or don't know if you believe or believed when you were a teenager and now feel kind of weird about it. It's all good, he says. There's no belief check at the door. From there, the morning flows along pretty familiar Church of England kind of lines.
So I'll just explain what's coming up. There's going to be a reading. There's going to be a talk. There's going to be more songs. There's going to be a minute of silence. How do we react to that? There's no better way to slightly freak out a room with a high amount of humanists and atheists than asking them to shut their eyes for a moment. You always get this look, is he going to trick us into praying?
There's a sermon too, but it's really more of a little arts degree lecture. Professor Chris Hartney is from Sydney University's theology department. This is his first ever sermon.
And I beside myself because I don't believe in God, and that's kind of cut me out of giving most sermons in my life. I work at the University of Sydney in the Department of Studies in Religion.
Professor Hartney's thesis basically is we're alone and that sucks. He thinks recent history has made us this way. He says the 21st century was brutal, the worst on record, and in the end there was the Cold War and this deep suspicion of anything collectivist. We've wound up, he says, living in this cult of the individual.
That I'm an individual and I don't need you. I don't need to humble myself before you. I don't need to ask for your help. I don't need to reach out for you because I am whole and complete as an individual myself. This is really bad stuff.
He is literally preaching to the choir. I think everyone is here today because they want to be part of something. they don't want to do it all on their own. That's why Cecilia's brought her little boys here, and there's also Brian, who's friendly and raises his hand to contribute and gives off really strong, mature-age student vibes. He tells me he grew up in a religious family, but things changed when he was a teenager.
You drifted from it in your teens. What was it at the time that put you off that kind of organized religion?
Girls. mates.
You got distracted, you mean?
Oh, I got distracted, but I got attracted to having a good time in life. And unfortunately, a lot of religions tell you don't have too much fun.
Brian's 71. He says he's had cancer twice. He's smoked a lot of weed. He's been to a lot of rock concerts. He has kids that love him. He's seen some things, and he thinks things could be better.
It's something that I thought I'd been looking for. I hadn't consciously been looking for it, but I know that there's something missing. Dr. Chris Hartney said that we're in a mess, the world's in a mess, because we've lost, there's something missing from, you know, what we're brought up to believe. So I actually agree with, I'm not a communist, but I don't like this individuality where, you know, you're the right to be individual overrides everything else to the detriment of society.
The Sunday assemblies are usually themed. Each morning loops around an idea, and that first Sunday was wonder. You don't have to believe in God to wonder, they were saying. I get that. I think that's why the Sunday assembly caught my attention. I think that's why you're still listening to this. I think that's why I was so stoked on that little red curl glowing behind that little boy's ear. I'm not religious, but I'm not spiritual. That said, I don't think I'll go back. Like all the other church sessions I've been to, it's daggy and I got a bit bored. The difference with this church is no one's telling me I'll go to hell for not turning up.
Let us all give thanks to Jacqueline Breen for that story. This episode of All the Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney, with Sin Radio in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to the producers who contributed to this episode, Zoe Ferguson and Jacqueline Breen, and thanks to Elizabeth Redmond for joining me in the studio. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. Our production manager is Pip Rasmussen, and our executive producers are Jordana Caputo and Belinda Lopez. And I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.